and learn about LSD from experts in psychiatry and pharmacology. I hope it takes us one step closer to learning what happened to Damien Hurd and who, if anyone, is responsible. From Cold Case Productions, this is Final Days on Earth, The Life and Death of Damien Hurd. Episode 9, The Arrest. I'm your host, Claire Santama. Thanks for listening. What made Damien leave the wrestler's house party in the dead of night is an enduring mystery. As we've discussed in previous episodes, no one has found a direct connection between Damien and the remote location east of Gunnison where his body was found. There is still another theory we haven't explored yet, one that could help explain why Damien would drive to a place like Cabin Creek under the cover of night. The day after Damien's body was found, Gunnison police officers spoke to two people who offered new information about alleged drug activity. In these interviews, Damien's roommates at the dorm both independently told police that Damien sold marijuana to students at Western. Unfortunately, neither of these interviews were audio recorded. But according to the written police report, the sources said Damien kept his stash of weed in his car and would bring students out to his vehicle to make the transaction. This is notable because it's a routine that involves Damien and his car, and an activity that presumably would require some secrecy, not unlike the scene at Cabin Creek. Even though marijuana is legal in Colorado, you still need to be 21 years old and have a license to sell it. At 20 years old, Damien met neither of the criteria. And there's something else that makes this tip stand out. It's actually corroborated by evidence found in Damien's car after his death. According to Gunnison Police Detective Chris Danos, when he opened the door to Damien's Saturn, he could smell burnt marijuana. In between the driver's and passenger seats, there was a bong that appeared to have been used recently. The console between the two seats was open and completely empty of contents. Other than the residue in the bong, there was no weed found in Damien's car. Could Damien have gone to Cabin Creek to sell weed? And was the idea of a drug sale used to lure the hot-headed wrestler out to a remote location after his fight with the track team? There are elements of the scene at Damien's car that are consistent with that theory, including signs of a robbery.
The whole inside of the car was in disarray. The whole car.
That's Damien's father, Gary Hurd. In episodes 3 and 4, we talked about the curious contents of Damien's car, including his disassembled cell phone, a brand new screwdriver set, and a bag of old hand tools. There was also a ready-to-mail package that had been ripped open and the contents removed. Because of the letters still inside the package, we know the missing item was a LeBron James t-shirt. It seems pretty clear that someone other than Damien opened that package in his car and stole the LeBron James t-shirt. But what about the rest of the scene? When Damien's wallet was found in his pocket, there was no cash inside. He also wasn't wearing any jewelry. It's curious because we know from bank records that Damien took $100 out of an ATM on Saturday, March 29th. Based on Damien's cell phone records, we know he spent $50 buying acid before he went missing. The other $50 has never been accounted for. We know it likely didn't go toward alcohol, because the wrestlers were using the leftover beer from the Crab Feed fundraiser at their party. We also know from photographs the night of Damien's disappearance that he was wearing flashy diamond stud earrings. In fact, they were a recent purchase, and their receipt was one of the items found in Damien's car. The earrings were cubic zirconia, but they shined like the real thing. To this day, they have never been found. In the dozens of interviews that police conducted in the aftermath of Damien's death, one of the most common refrains was that the cops weren't looking to get anyone in trouble for alcohol or drugs.
There's talk that people that are talking to the cops about this, that their name is going out to the school, and that the school is threatening to, like, suspend people.
That's Western State student Lauren Dolliffe talking to Detective Chris Danos.
That's good to know. That is good to know.
It's just a rumor. I just wanted to make sure.
I don't work for the school. I'm not looking into anything for the school. This is only specific to me trying to figure out what happened to Damien, and that was it.
Danos had a similar conversation with wrestler Andrew Morris.
You know, you've been guarded to say you were buying the beer and it was yours and you were doing this, and I'm not looking at getting anybody in trouble for buying booze or anything like that.
Andrew was one of the roommates at the Wrestling House on North Taylor Street, the house where the party was held on Saturday night, March 29th. It's the last place anyone admits seeing Damien alive. The other roommates were Courtney Birch, Kyle Pyatt, and Elliot Copeland. This is Detective Danos talking to Elliot.
Since I've been looking into this, there's been some reports of substances other than alcohol being consumed at your house, or consumed that night. Are you aware of anything? Any drugs, narcotics being?
No.
I'm talking about you personally know because you saw it or somebody said, hey, I just did this.
No, I there was rumors after that night about like Damien being on drugs. But that night...
And when you say rumors, do you remember anybody specifically telling you that they witnessed it or they were a party to it or anything like that?
No, I just remember Kyle saying that Coach asked him like if Damien was on drugs that night because it was rumored that he had been on drugs.
Okay.
Although the cops like to say they weren't investigating drug or alcohol use, it seemed to be where most of their attention was focused. This is Detective Grace Cowan.
Do you remember seeing any strange like drug activity going on or anything? And we're not investigating that part of it, which is...
I'm actually really naive about that stuff.
Okay.
I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
Police concentrated on the idea that Damien was on narcotics.
Was there anything else that night that you were aware of or maybe you were told of that he had consumed other than booze?
No, not that night.
And since then, have you heard of anything he might have consumed?
No.
And I'm talking about narcotics. I'm not talking about food or booze.
Yeah. No, nothing that I know of.
Okay.
While none of the roommates at the Wrestling House admitted knowing anything about Damien taking drugs, other partygoers told police a different story. This is Sean Sepala, a senior wrestler.
He told me that he had done acid
that
night, and I'm sure you guys already know that, so...
According to Sean, around 9 o'clock on Saturday night at the party, Damien said he was feeling good.
We were just hanging out, sitting on the couch. He was like, yeah, I'm tripping right now.
And did he go any further about it? Did he say what was going on?
I asked him how I felt, and he said he felt good. Like, I don't know.
He wasn't freaking out, seeing crazy things, nothing like that?
No, he said that he was liking it.
In interviews, it was common for students to say they couldn't remember the names of their friends who were on drugs, especially the ones taking acid with Damien. Naturally, this raised some eyebrows with detectives.
So you can't remember any of those other kids that said that they were also using acid?
No.
Or are you just afraid to tell me?
No, I'm not afraid to tell you because it wouldn't be in your best interest to pursue anybody that, you know, for drug use that might help you solve a crime. That's your actual concern.
The closest police ever got to identifying who was taking acid with Damien came from Western student Dalton Caudill. Here he is talking to Detective Chris Danos.
You had knowledge secondhand from talking with somebody that Damien Hurd had consumed acid on Saturday, the 29th of March.
Actually, I heard it from one of my buddies, and apparently the guy that was there took the same acid as him. He only took one tab and said it was the strongest trip of his life. And Damien took two.
It sounded like you weren't too excited about providing names and whatnot. And I want to assure you, my investigation is not a narcotics investigation. It's trying to determine what happened to Damien.
I know he was on the cross-country team. I'm looking at the roster right now to try to see if the name rings a bell. He's only a kid anyway. I just can't remember for the life of me. Let me see.
So the kid that actually used the acid with Damien's on the cross-country team?
Yes, sir.
Just one day after hearing that someone on the cross-country team did acid with Damien, the Gunnison Police Department would receive yet another unexpected tip call. On April 17th, a detective named Joe Arp in McKinney, Texas, called the Gunnison Police Department. McKinney is a suburb north of Dallas, about an hour away from Damien's hometown. The call was not recorded, but according to the written report, ARP told Detective Danos that there had recently been 4 overdoses involving a synthetic form of LSD. It was identified as 25B-NBOME, street name N-Bomb. What's more, ARP's tipster told him that the wrestler who died in Gunnison, Colorado, had taken N-Bomb with a member of the cross-country team named Travis or Tyler. I wanted to find out more about the tip, so I decided to give Detective ARP a call and see if he'd talk to me.
Detective ARP.
Hi, Detective. It's Claire Santama.
Unlike the cops in Colorado involved in this case, the lone Texas lawman was willing to chat on the record.
Anytime somebody dies at that age, there's just, you know, always something suspicious, if that makes sense. You know, you always wonder what played a part in that.
Talking to Detective ARP was already feeling like a breath of fresh air. My first question was about the source of his tip.
The information I got was from a person who wanted to remain anonymous. That's how we, you know, as narcotics detectives, that's how we do a lot of our work. So we, you know, we sure don't gain very much credibility with people if we identify them. So I don't want to do that.
Was it something that someone called you out of the blue and provided this tip to you? Or was it in person? Or do you remember the
they called out of the blue. It was definitely out of the blue. That's a lot of what we do is just gather intel and pass it on from agency to agency. You know, that's just constantly what we do is gather intel. But, you know, most of the time it's not about Colorado. Most of the time it's about a town in Texas close by.
Detective ARP went on to say that the tip was delivered as third-party information. In other words, a friend of a friend told the tipster that the wrestler who died in Gunnison, Colorado, had taken N-Bomb with a member of the cross-country team.
It's just not considered very valuable as far as information. It needs cooperation, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
It's interesting because element of the tip, as I saw it in the Gunnison police report, was that one of the people that did acid with Damien was on the cross-country team. And that was something that I heard from other witnesses independent of your anonymous witness. So that part of it's intriguing to me.
It wasn't like it's a regular informant of mine or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I would only be speculating if I said how I thought. You know, I've kind of got my own thoughts of how this person, why they wanted to call the police and report it, but I...
We're not in a court of law. We're just talking. So if you want to give me your theory, I'd love to hear it.
For lack of better words, I think it was a concerned citizen that knew somebody up there or was close to somebody up there.
ARP's anonymous source said the wrestler got N-Bomb from a guy on the cross-country team named Travis or Tyler. The 2014 Western State track and field roster didn't include anyone named Travis, but there were 2 Tylers. Both were cross-country runners. Gunnison police tracked them down.
Interview with Tyler, last name spelling is S-E-I-Z. This is Detective Cowan. The date is the 5th of May, 2014. So, Tyler, the reason I had you come in today is we're investigating the Damien Hurd incident. And do you know him?
No, I don't know him at all. I mean, I've seen him... on the posters and stuff.
Okay. But never met him?
Oh, no.
This Tyler tells Detective Cowan that he had ankle surgery on March 12th and had only recently started to walk again. He says he wasn't at the party the weekend Damien disappeared on March 29th.
Have you heard anything?
All I heard was that there was a party and he was there and someone got in a fight or something. I don't really know all the details.
Detective Cowan got right down to business.
I'm going to ask you a question. Have you ever heard of the drug named N-Bomb?
No.
No? Okay.
N-Bomb?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No. Okay. Well, I guess if you don't know him, you've never met him, makes our interview kind of easy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The detective spoke to the other cross-country Tyler 2 days later.
This is Detective Cowan, interview with Tyler Gates. It is the 7th of May, 2014.
Right off the bat, this Tyler sounded a lot more promising.
You know Damien?
Yeah.
Okay. And how do you know him?
He was my suite mate.
Okay.
So, he's a wrestler, and my roommate, Frankie, was a wrestler.
We've heard from Tyler and Frankie before, in previous episodes.
And did you guys ever hang out together?
Not really. I mean, we were, like, always friendly with each other. But he's always kind of with the wrestling team. I was always kind of with the track team.
Tyler says that on March 29th, he didn't attend the party at the wrestler's house, and he didn't go to the track party either.
One of the reasons I have you in here, Tyler, is because we got some information, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong on this, is that somebody from the cross-country team consumed some acid with Damien that night.
I'm not sure.
Do you know anything about that?
No, because the only thing I know is what I heard, oh, Damien was on, he drank too much alcohol, and then I heard he was on acid, then I heard he just kind of like, the story kept like exaggerating and coming back. Like, I never really knew what he was on.
Okay.
So I don't know if anyone did it with him, but I heard he was on something.
Okay. But you weren't that person.
Oh, no.
That consumed acid with him that night.
Yeah.
Because one of the things is the information that we got was that it was somebody with the name Tyler.
Oh, I didn't see him all Saturday before the party.
Okay.
So, I mean, I didn't know he was missing until Monday.
Detective Cowan keeps pressing.
And the reason we're discussing the drug use thing is that could have played a part in what's happened.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people don't want to talk about that and feel like you might get in trouble, or if you know any information, you don't want to get your friends in trouble. I hope that's not the case, because it really truly would and assist our investigation if you do know anything. And it is a death investigation, so it's somewhat important.
I mean, the only thing I could assume is, at least for cross-country and track, I mean, most people, they drink,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think anyone should really, especially, like, that weekend, because we had morning practice Saturday and Sunday
mm-hmm.
at 9 in the morning.
On Saturday and?
And Sunday.
Sunday, okay.
Yeah. So I, honestly, I don't know.
Have you ever heard of the drug, N-bomb?
No.
Before? Anybody say it around campus or anything like that? That you've heard of?
Are there any other names for it?
I'd have to ask the other detective. But it's basically a synthetic of LSD.
Oh, okay.
So it's not really LSD, but it's kind of part of that category. And we did get information that he may have used some acid, and particularly with an athlete from the cross-country team.
Okay.
So that's why you're in here.
Okay.
I have talked to the other Tyler that's on the team.
For?
Same reason. I'm talking to you. So I hope you're telling me the truth, that you didn't participate in that.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, as we go on, your name, if it comes up that you did, I mean, you know, I will be talking to you again. Hopefully you've been honest with me.
Yeah.
Okay.
As far as I can tell, detectives never talked to Tyler Gates or any other member of the cross-country team again. After receiving the tip about Damien and M-bomb, authorities in Gunnison requested an additional toxicology screen as part of his autopsy. I wanted to learn more about M-bomb, so I reached out to an addiction psychiatrist and leading expert on the drug. Hi, Dr. Suzuki?
Yeah, speaking.
This is Dr. Joji Suzuki, Director of the Division of Addiction Psychiatry at Brigham Women's Hospital in Boston and an Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Suzuki explained that scientists develop M-bomb to better study how the brain works.
It was created to be a highly selective serotonin agonist as a neuroimaging marker. Of course, you know, like so many other things, it escaped the laboratory, entered into the, you know, the market, as people call it, for recreational use. And it became popular, you know, I would say starting around 10 years ago.
Dr. Suzuki was the lead author on a 2014 article examining a suicide attempt by a college freshman who tested positive for N-bomb. Naturally, my curiosity was piqued by Dr. Suzuki's area of expertise and his possible insight into Damien's case. His first nugget of wisdom was the correct pronunciation.
How does N-bomb differ from traditional LSD?
N-bomb, N-bomy, however you want to call it, is a very different chemical. So N-bomy is actually a laboratory-created compound. The come-up is similar, the duration is similar, the overall sort of psychedelic experiences, you know, is comparable. And so if you've never used LSD, for example, then you would never know the difference. Except for the fact that, you know, it's extremely, like, has a metallic taste, and so it's a bitter, bitter taste that's quite distinct from LSD, which is generally considered, you know, without any flavor.
The most common side effects of drugs like LSD are hallucinations. Your senses are distorted in ways ranging from blurred vision to imagining things that aren't there at all. The associated paranoia, anxiety, and panic attacks are commonly referred to as a bad trip.
Most psychedelics are generally safe. There are some sort of bad actors out there. And N-bomy, I would put that in the category, especially, you know, if you can't be sure about dosage issues. You know, it's just so easy to take too much.
According to at least one source, Damien took two hits of what he believed to be LSD.
And invariably, you know, some of the people who were taking N-bomy had very, very bad reactions to it. It seems to have a propensity for people to get into problems much more than LSD ever did. I think LSD has been given to millions of people at this time, and the overall sort of adverse effect profile is well described, generally safe, self-limited duration of these problems. But N-bomy has been around for a very short period of time, and a huge number of very, very problematic outcomes being reported.
Whether Damien was on traditional LSD or the synthetic version N-bomy, the acute psychological effects of acid last between 6 and 10 hours. The earliest Damien could have taken acid was 6 p.m. on Saturday, when he made his first purchase from Curtis Markham at Mountaineer Village apartment complex. That would put Damien's trip ending between 1 a.m. when he was seen pumping gas and 4 a.m.
Could you comment on how common suicidal tendencies are for people under the influence of N-bomy?
We don't think it's that common. Overall, actual suicide attempts on psychedelics is considered extremely rare. Now, there are many cases of people getting into accidents, like running off, you know, because you're paranoid and running into traffic. That's not suicide, right? That's like an accidental death.
Right.
You know, you're tripping bad and then you're paranoid and you're scared and you run off and then you didn't realize you're running off a bridge. That's not a suicide. I was involved in a case up in Canada where a dealer sold N-bomy to an 18-year-old kid. He was tripping out so hard, he didn't know what was going on. He ended up just kind of crouching down in the middle of the snowstorm, and he was found frozen to death the next morning.
In fact, many of Damien's friends told police they thought Damien might have frozen to death after he disappeared. But as we now know, Damien's demise was much more complicated than that.
Accidental self-harm, I think, happens, you know, more than we like to see. But actual suicides, we don't think it's that common. In fact, the paper that we publish is the only paper that I know of that talks about an actual suicide attempt during a psychedelic trip.
Dr. Suzuki's 2014 paper is gamely titled, "My Friend Said It Was Good LSD, a Suicide Attempt Following Analytically Confirmed 2,5-I N-bomy Ingestion." The subject of the paper, who was referred to by the pseudonym Mr. B, had several things in common with Damien. Mr. B is an 18-year-old college freshman who takes N-bomy in a friend's dorm room for the first time. Mr. B says that the effects of the drug, which his friend told him was good LSD, took several hours to intensify. Once he was tripping, Mr. B wanted to be alone and went back to his own dorm room. Next, he described feeling trapped and becoming increasingly anxious and confused to the point where he considered suicide as a way to end the experience. Mr. B used a pair of scissors to stab himself repeatedly in the neck and chest. Some 11 hours later, he came to and called 911, saying he tried to kill himself after taking, quote, two hits of acid.
He really stabbed himself in the neck and chest in a very big way, and he needed surgery to repair those injuries. That was a clear suicide attempt.
This is so fascinating to me, and I really want to get your opinion on this, because everything you're saying about, you know, these accidental deaths, stabbings, you know, running into traffic, that is so different than what happened to Damien. The cases that you're talking about, I mean, these are very uncomplicated ways to harm yourself. Whereas Damien, it's believed that he drove his car to this remote area and presumably in the middle of the night hiked up this rocky, frozen cliffside in Colorado, fashioned a noose out of jumper cables, tied it to a tree branch, you know, got into it and killed himself that way. You know, that's a lot of steps to do if you're on a hallucinogen.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a very, I mean, that's very intentional, right? When you're tripping that hard, it becomes hard to engage in very goal-oriented behavior and tasks. Even making a noose and, like, you know, hanging it from the tree and doing all that, if you're really tripping so hard that you're so out of your mind that you're going to kill yourself, like, that will be a pretty challenging thing to do. You know, running into the traffic, that's easy, but creating a noose and sort of going through with that requires a level of organization that I think you begin to lose when you're tripping that hard.
The question on the top of Dr. Suzuki's mind, was Damien really on LSD at all?
Because if he was gone for 4 days, and the question is, did the suicide occur when he was intoxicated on LSD or not? Then the timing issue is actually quite important.
According to Damien's toxicology results, his blood indicated the presence of LSD in the amount of 0.26 nanograms per milliliter. Damien disappeared on Saturday, March 29th, and was found on Wednesday, April 2nd. His autopsy was performed on Thursday, April 3rd. Could this data help us understand the timing of Damien's death? I reached out to another leading psychedelic expert to try to find out.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Dr. Passy.
Yeah, right.
Yes, this is Claire Sanema.
Yeah, I expected you. So my name is Thorsten Passy. I'm a professor of psychiatry and psychotherapy at Hanover Medical School and at Frankfurt Goethe University. The other thing is that I'm maybe the leading expert on the pharmacology of psychedelic drugs, especially LSD.
Dr. Passy has worked as a clinical and research psychiatrist for over 30 years. He wrote a book in 2010 called The Pharmacology of LSD. I told Dr. Passy about Damien's case and that his autopsy indicated the presence of LSD at 0.26 nanograms per milliliter. His response surprised me.
There is no way established that you can detect LSD in a person already dead. This can't be done. There's no safe way to really detect the amount of LSD in the right way, which is in the blood.
That's very interesting.
It is important to know. I know that for sure.
The reason, Dr. Passy says, is a simple scientific principle. There's just not enough data.
Can't really determine levels in a person 3 days dead. This is not established. As you can think of, right? How many people do we have? And so there is very, very, very little experience in respect to that. There are so many unknowns in the forensic analysis that you, in principle, can forget that in respect to blood levels. But you might still be able to detect that he has taken LSD. That might be true. I would believe in that.
Okay. Right? Okay.
But not in the level. The blood level is completely unreliable.
It's a frustrating answer. But in Damien's case, not an unusual one. Unreliable information is a reoccurring theme. There are so many tips and leads that sound promising at first, but are never proven true. The latest example? Was Damien on synthetic LSD, street name N-Bom, or traditional LSD? The Gunnison Medical Examiner screened for the compound N-Bomy because of the tip call from Detective Joe Arp in McKinney, Texas. But when the test came back 3 months later, Damien was negative for N-Bomy. Here again is Dr. Suzuki.
You're saying that the testing was entirely negative for N-Bomy or other types of psychedelics that we might be suspecting, other than LSD.
So as far as I know, and according to the toxicology report that I'm looking at right now, they screened for N-Bomy and it was none detected, and they screened for LSD and it was detected.
Which N-Bomy did they test for?
It says drug screens N-B-O-M-E.
Right, so there's different types of N-Bomies.
Dr. Suzuki explained that there are three separate chemical compounds for N-Bomy. There's 2,5-I, 2,5-B, and 2,5-C.
Back in 2014, N-Bomy was still in its early days. Only some of the, you know, really astute medical examiners would even be aware of N-Bomy. So I'd be curious to know if back then whether they truly tested for the different types of N-Bomies, specifically 2,5-I, 2,5-B, or 2,5-C. If they only tested for one N-Bomy, or, you know, there still remains the possibility that they simply didn't test for all of the different analogs.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and I'd never considered, whenever I saw it on there, I thought, well, they tested for it, and it wasn't, yeah. You know, wasn't found.
You know, 2014 is sort of the time when N-Bomy had just come out, and it's really when even the dealers were really unsure about ensuring that people were taking the right dosages. Because I truly believe that some of the problems that we were seeing was partly due to the fact that, you know, many of the dealers were very careless.
Using text messages from Damien's cell phone, police trace back his purchase of LSD to two dealers, fellow Western State students Preston Claybrook and Curtis Markham. Despite what police repeatedly told kids during their interviews, both students were charged with drug-related crimes based on their actions the night Damien disappeared. Markham was arrested for unlawful distribution of a Schedule 1 controlled substance. Claybrook was arrested for complicity in the sale. As part of my research, I read every news report I could get my hands on about Damien's case. When I got to the article from October 23, 2014 in the Gunnison Country Times, I was immediately drawn to the mugshots of the two students. Many agencies require suspects to wear jail attire for their mugshots, but the Gunnison Police Department does no such thing. And I was struck by the image of Preston Claybrook, because his t-shirt had a prominent cancer awareness ribbon on it. If you recall, when hiker Linda Nienhauser spoke to police, she specifically remembered a cancer awareness license plate being on the white truck at Cabin Creek. When I zoomed in on Claybrook's photo, I saw his t-shirt also had a name on it, Janaea Aguilera. Naturally, I followed the lead, and I found Aguilera's obituary. After a long and painful battle with bone cancer, Aguilera died peacefully in her sleep on April 28, 2014. The timing puts Aguilera's death about a month after Damien's. It occurred to me that if I had a friend in the throes of a battle with cancer, that would be the time I would be most likely to feel zealous about cancer awareness. Of course, it must be noted that Linda believed she saw a pink cancer awareness ribbon, and the official color of bone cancer awareness is yellow. Claybrook's mugshot is in black and white, but it feels safe to assume that the ribbon on his shirt is likely yellow. Yes, it might just be a coincidence, but still, I couldn't shake the possible connection to cancer awareness paraphernalia on Claybrook and the unidentified vehicle of interest at Cabin Creek. As far as I am aware, Gunnison police never explored the theory that Damien could have gone to Cabin Creek for a drug deal. Preston Claybrook's name appears on only one page of Damien's case file, and Curtis Markham's only comes up twice. There's no recorded interview with either Claybrook or Markham listed in the evidence log. This is especially strange considering they were the only people ever charged in connection with Damien's case. The same day that Markham and Claybrook were arrested, Gunnison police announced they were closing the Damien Hurd death investigation and ruling it a suicide. The final entry in the 187-page police report reads, "Case closed, non-criminal." It wasn't the resolution that many had hoped for in Damien's case. In fact, it felt pretty hollow. Two narcotics arrests end a death investigation case that wasn't even supposed to be about drugs? How could this be the conclusion of Damien's story? There were still so many unanswered questions.
In my mind, that lingers. Is there any chance that this could have been Ndomi or not? In my mind, that remains an open question. So I'd be curious to know if the police have any of the, evidence still available. It would seem incomplete if you didn't make sure that the testing was adequate.
The arrest of two Western students for selling Damien LSD and the Gunnison Police Department's closure of his case were presented as related, with Damien's use of LSD leading to his suicide. But according to experts, the connection isn't so cut and dry. While anything's possible, aggressive and goal-oriented behavior is not the norm on LSD. Here again is Dr. Torsten Passy.
Do you find that these suicidal tendencies are common for people under the influence of LSD?
No, they are not. But in a very desperate situation, these kind of things might come up. Especially if you have no experience with the drug. They can go into states of mind where they are very narrow. They kind of minimize their mental space. You know, they think, I just can jump out the window. There's no alternative. Your mind gets smaller, you know, so that you are an idiot at last. You don't know what you're doing.
But somebody at Cabin Creek did know what they were doing, from disassembling Damien's cell phone to tying a jumper cable noose and finding just the right place to hang it. Was that person Damien or someone else? The idea that Damien was picking fights while tripping on acid surprised both the experts I spoke with. Here again is Dr. Joji Suzuki.
Just that fact alone, that 2 hours after taking 2 hits of acid, that he jumped some guy?
Yeah.
Already is sort of like a weird situation.
Dr. Passy agreed.
These cases that somebody was hurt by a person on LSD are so rare, it's unbelievably rare.
Really?
It's 1 out of 1,000,000 or less.
On the next episode of Final Days on Earth, The Life and Death of Damien Hurd, the Gunnison Police Department enlists the help of an outside agency to review Damien's case.
It seemed clear to me that the impetus for his review was your disbelief that Damien had killed himself.
And also he was not happy with the fact that I had been on the news and on social media chastising the Gunnison Police Department and how they were handling the investigation. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that they really weren't trying that hard to do anything other than prove suicide.
Final Days on Earth is recorded in Dallas, Texas for Cold Case Productions in partnership with Podcast One and Live by Live. Each episode is written, reported, and produced by me, Claire Sanimal. Original theme music composed and performed by Riley Simmons. Songs licensed from PremiumBeat.com are Bending Truth and A Thin Line. Editorial consultant is Lucy Scott of LucyMedia.com. Additional production help from Amber Robinson, Janice Sue, and Elise Weber. Executive producers are Sharon Richards and me, Claire Sanimal. Special thanks to Gary Hurd, Detective Joe Arp, Dr. Joji Suzuki, and Dr. Torsten Passy for talking to me in this episode. Tune in next week as we continue our search to understand what happened to Damien Hurd and who, if anyone, is responsible.